Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Hello, thanks for joining the program. We're talking about someone, ourselves or others, stealing the credit for work someone else did. Of course, the Buddhist advice is not to take credit for what is not ours. But last week, we addressed the question of what to do when someone else takes credit for our work. We saw that it's a mistake to immediately accuse the other person. Perhaps they didn't even realize what they'd done. We came across kleptonomesia. When through a trick of the mind, a person really thinks they have a new idea, when in fact they have come across it before. And cryptomnesia, where we mistake a memory for an original thought. Both of these can play a part in making it seem someone is stealing our work, when in fact their mind has been hijacked. Rather than going off the deep end, we would do better to stay calm, assess how important taking credit actually is, and if we decide to take it further, to question the other person to find out what was really going on. If they admit their wrongdoing, we can then work out a remedy so that others become aware of how much credit is due to us. And if they don't, we can calmly and rationally work out how we will proceed so that it doesn't happen again. Now, the reason we're covering this topic in the first place is a slogan in the text we've been following, Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun. The slogan is, don't sprint to win the race, and we've seen that commentaries have interpreted it in a number of ways. It could mean that we shouldn't end a project with a spurt of effort, so that it seems and we can claim that we did the majority of work. It also means don't always race ahead to try to guess the best for oneself, and especially in spiritual work, don't get all intense with the aim to prove to everyone that you are the best practitioner. In other words, don't make spiritual practice into a competition. The next slogan in the text is, don't turn gods into devils. But before we find out what this means, let's take a pause and remember our motivation as we usually do. Let's try to make that motivation bodhicitta, the determination to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, as we usually do. But if that's too much, think that this program will at least be a cause for your own enlightenment. But bodhicitta brings much greater merit. On the benefits of bodhicitta, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, the spiritual master who heads the Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition, has this to say on the website of Lama Yeshe Archive, www.lamayeshe.com. The Sutra Dode Palpoche, which contains teachings on bodhicitta, says, the holy altruistic mind of enlightenment, that purest of attitudes, is a treasury of merits. The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life says, how can one measure the merits one collects by generating the precious thought that is the cause of all happiness of all transmigratory beings and the medicine that cures the suffering of all sentient beings? From where does one single happiness, both temporary and ultimate, of every single sentient being come? From bodhicitta. What is the one medicine for every suffering that sentient beings experience? That too is bodhicitta. Therefore, there's no limit to the benefits of bodhicitta. There's no way to realize how much merit you can collect with it. You can't say it's this much. It's immeasurable. The merits you can collect with bodhicitta are numberless. That is the straight translation. How can the merits collected by generating the precious thought that is the cause of the happiness of all transmigratory beings and the medicine for all sufferings of all sentient beings be measured? With the mind of bodhicitta, each breath in and each breath out becomes a cause for the happiness of all sentient beings. With this purest of attitudes, bodhicitta, every breath you take benefits each sentient being, and with each breath, with every action, you create skies of merit. Therefore, if you want to accumulate the conditions necessary for attaining realizations on the path to enlightenment, you should put all your effort into developing your own precious mind of bodhicitta. When you think of fulfilling your wishes, it's not suffering you want. Normally, you don't wish for suffering. What you wish for is happiness. Of course, the happiness that most of us wish for is actually suffering. What we usually think of as happiness is not pure happiness. However, as far as what we wish for is concerned, from the side of the wish, what we are looking for is happiness, not suffering. That said, every single happiness, from that of full enlightenment, through liberation from samsara, and the happiness of future lives, down to even the happiness of this life, depends on merit, good karma. Without good karma, nothing works. Without good karma, the cause of happiness, you can't enjoy even the slightest happiness. Without merit, there's no comfort. Everything depends on merit. Realizations of the path, temporary happiness, even the work of this life, such as success in business, every single thing depends on merit. So, what's the best way to collect extensive merit? It's by practicing bodhicitta, meditating on bodhicitta. Also, the merit you collect with bodhicitta is inexhaustible, unceasing. It doesn't stop until you reach enlightenment. And even after you reach enlightenment, it continues. You continuously experience the result. Your mind remains in the state of peerless happiness. And not only that, as a result of the merits you collect with bodhicitta, you liberate numberless other sentient beings and bring them to full enlightenment. Without discriminating, you bring the sentient beings equaling the sky, every single one, to the full enlightenment of Buddhahood. The teachings say that merits collected without bodhicitta are like a water tree. I think that means a banana tree. The fruit comes, you use it once, and the tree no longer bears fruit. In other words, if merit is created without bodhicitta, you experience the result once and it's finished. Merit collected with bodhicitta is completely different. You enjoy it all the time, lifetime after lifetime. And even after you achieve enlightenment, you keep enjoying it. Such merit is inexhaustible. And that is Lama Zopa Rinpoche. Thus we can see that with a mind of bodhicitta, even just participating in this program can become a cause for our enlightenment. So if you can make this your motivation, then please do. Thank you. And now back to Nam Kha Pal and mind training like the rays of the sun. As I said, the next slogan is, don't turn gods into devils. And Nam Kha Pal, the author, comments, just as you can lose your life if you make mistakes in the process of cultivating worldly gods, which is known as gods turning into devils, so once you have entered into the practice of mind training, if any aspect of your listening, contemplation, and meditation provokes your misconception of self and serves to increase it, it is known as turning gods into devils. Please see that this does not happen. Now let's explain this in a little bit of a roundabout way with an example from Greek mythology. The site www.greeka.com covers everything Greek, including stories from the ancient Greek pantheon. One of these is the tale of Niobe, and this is what the site says. The tragic tale of Niobe is one of the most memorable Greek myths, for Niobe's story features a striking example of the consequences of hubris, a Greek term defined as arrogance or excessive pride. This myth was popular in ancient literature, poetry, and art. Therefore, it is not a surprise that the legend of Niobe appears in one of our oldest and best sources for Greek myths, the Iliad of Homer. The tragic tale of Niobe is one of the most poignant in Greek mythology. Her father was Tantalus, king of a town above Mount Sipylus in Anatolia, but we do not know exactly who her mother was. Niobe had two brothers, Broteus and Pelops, who would later be a legendary hero and would give his name to Peloponnese. When Niobe grew up, she got married to Amphion, king of Thebes. Now, this was a turning point in her life, and a series of tragic events followed to give her a distinct place in one of the most tragic dramas in Greek mythology. Niobe and Amphion gave birth to 14 children, 7 sons and 7 daughters. At a ceremony held in honor of Leto, the mother of the divine twins Apollo and Artemis, who was also living in Thebes, Niobe, in a fit of arrogance, bragged about her 14 children. In fact, Niobe said that she was superior to Leto, as she had 14 children and not only two. Now, when the twins knew this insult, they got enraged and at once came down to earth to kill the children of Niobe. Apollo, the god of light and music, killed all seven of Niobe's sons with his powerful arrows in front of their mother's eyes. Although Niobe was pleading Apollo to feel mercy for her last surviving son, Apollo's lethal arrow had already left his bow to find its mark with deadly accuracy, thus wiping out all the male descendants of Niobe. Artemis, the virgin goddess of nature and hunting, killed Niobe's seven daughters with her lethal arrows, and their dead bodies were lying unburied for 9 days. Devastated by the slaughter of his children, Amphion committed suicide. Some versions say that he too was killed by Apollo when he tried to avenge his children's deaths. And so it was that Niobe's entire family had been wiped out by the gods in a matter of moments, and in deep anguish she ran to Mount Sipylus. There she pleaded with the gods to give an end to her pain. Zeus felt sorry for her and transformed her into a rock to make her feelings of stone. However, even as a rock, Niobe continued to cry. Her endless tears poured forth as a stream from the rock, and it seems to stand as a moving reminder of a mother's eternal mourning. To this day, Niobe is mourning for her children, and people believe that her faint image can still be seen carved on a limestone rock cliff on Mount Sipylus, with the water that seeps out of the porous rocks bearing a strong allusion to her ceaseless tears. The tragic tale of Niobe centered on the consequences of hubris, a strange concept in the Greek antiquity, which said that if you act with arrogance towards the gods, then you will be punished. Actually, Niobe's story is a classic example of the wrath of gods against human weaknesses, and has been beautifully narrated in Homer's Iliad. The tale of Niobe also finds mention in Metamorphoses, a narrative poem written by the renowned Roman poet Ovid. Now, how does this relate to the mind-training teachings we are following? Well, gods are supposed to be those supernatural beings that can help us, while devils are those that will harm us. In that sense, we could regard the teachings as a god, because if we practice them, they will definitely help us. But there is the danger that when we realize some benefit from them, we get haughty and think we are now better than other ordinary people. For instance, if we get through a difficult situation well because of our mind training, but someone else in the same situation doesn't cope so well, we might feel superior and think something like, "Oh, look how much better I am as a person than she is, because I've been practicing Buddhism and mind training. Poor thing." That is turning a god into a devil, in the same way as Niobe developed so much pride because she had more children than Leto. When that happened, Leto's children, the gods Apollo and Artemis, turned into devils that caused all sorts of problems for Niobe. In the same way, using the mind training, or any of the Buddha's teachings for that matter, to increase our sense of self and pride, is turning something that can help free us from suffering into something that is just going to increase our suffering exponentially. B. Alan Wallace, in his commentary, The 7 Points of Mind Training, alludes to this when, translating the slogan into "Do not let the gods descend to the devil," he writes, "The commentary speaks first of devas, gods like those of the Hindu or Greek pantheons. Many accounts suggest that these non-human beings can be rather fickle. If you honor and worship them, they may help you. If you don't, they may turn around and injure you, in which case the god descends to a devil, an inflictor of harm." What does it really mean for the divine to descend to the diabolical? The point of the mind training is to subdue our own mind, to gradually vanquish self-grasping and the mental afflictions that arise from it. No matter how intensely, earnestly, and diligently we practice, we may still inflate ourselves with a sense of superiority, using our spiritual practice as an unfortunate source of conceit. This distortion of the practice is the descent from a deva to a demon, from a god to a devil. Why do we engage in any spiritual practice? The answer that Buddhism emphasizes is our own vulnerability to suffering, whether blatant or as an undercurrent of anxiety. If we are deeply aware that we need help and recognize that without Dharma our minds are dysfunctionally creating misery, it becomes ridiculous to hold a supercilious attitude. It is hard to be pompous when the reason for practicing is a desire to be free of our own mental distortions. The Four Noble Truths, the existence of suffering, the source of suffering, freedom from suffering and its source, and the means of achieving such freedom, are very sobering in this regard. And that is Alan Wallace. Trungpa Rinpoche says something similar in his commentary on the 7 points of mind training. He writes, "Suppose we are practicing mind training and things are going very well. We may then develop pride in our accomplishments and think, oh, I did so well in this mind training that now I'm really a great practitioner. Or we might develop envy for others who are progressing much more rapidly than we are. In both these cases, we are making a god into a demon. In this analogy, the mind training practice, which goes well for us or for someone else, is like a god. If this accomplishment creates a negative emotion such as pride, then it's like a demon. Don't make a god into a demon means don't degrade the practice of mind training. We're trying to cultivate the noble heart of bodhicitta, but then we may become proud of ourselves because of being a bodhisattva and think we're special and superior to others who are not doing so. This is called degrading one's purity, in the sense that it hardens our sensitivity so that we don't really care for others and are more inclined to be rude. And that is called turning a god into a demon or degrading the practice." And also, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche in Enlightened Courage has this to say, commenting on his translation, "Do not bring a god down to the level of a demon." He says, "Worldly people use their religion in order to have success in business, to acquire power and situations of prosperity. But if they fall sick, lose their possessions and so on, they think their gods are displeased and begin to think of them as demons. If through the mind training we become proud and boastful, it will be as Gompopa once said, Dharma not practiced properly will bring us down to the lower realms. If we become pretentious and conceited, we will certainly not be practicing Dharma. Because of our pride, the mind training, instead of taming us as it should, will make us all the more hard and obstinate. If the medicine we take is unsuited to the illness we have, our condition will be all the worse. In the same way, we should apply the teaching so that they act as an antidote to our ego clinging. Towards everyone, we should consider ourselves the humblest of servants, taking the lowest place. We should try really very hard to be modest and self-forgetting." Now, it is of course true that the focus of religion for many ordinary people is the well-being of this life. People go to monks for pujas for health, blessing ceremonies and wealth rituals, but also become disillusioned when the religious practices don't appear to work or make a difference. These are not people engaged in mind training. However, the pursuit of religion for worldly concerns can go much further. In the East, there have been stories of Buddhist monks who have garnered big reputations and enough wealth to own a Mercedes-Benz or even a jet. But it seems that in the West, Christianity has gone even further with what is called prosperity theology or prosperity gospel. In New Zealand, we have Bishop Tamaki and the Destiny Church. And America has pastors like Lakewood Church's Joel Osteen, who is reportedly worth $50 million. They preach a message of giving to the church in tune with Ken Copeland's book, Laws of Prosperity, where he says, "Do you want a 100-fold return on your money? Give and let God multiply it back to you. No bank in the world offers this kind of return. Praise the Lord." Prosperity gospel has even spread to Africa. And on churchleaders.com, Bob Dittmer describes what's happening in an article titled "Meet the Man Making Money Off Christianity in Africa." He writes, "Over the past 20 years, Christianity in Africa has grown, but there are grave concerns over what is happening in the name of Christianity on the continent. Conrad Mbewe, pastor of Kabwata Baptist Church in Lusaka, Zambia, and who's been called the African Spurgeon, said prosperity teaching is an unwelcome guest that has taken up permanent residence in Africa. A Reformed Baptist, he hopes to see a revival of the true gospel in Africa. In a 2015 article for the Gospel Coalition, he wrote, "We need to address prosperity theology here in Africa because it has replaced the true gospel of salvation with a kind of gospel that is no gospel at all. This is happening in what once were mainstream evangelical circles. Everywhere, especially on radio and television, almost all you hear is this message about how God in Christ wants us to be physically healthy and materially prosperous. You hardly ever hear sermons about sin and repentance." As an example, Bob Dittmer brings up Bishop Daniel Angel Obinim, the founder of International God's Way Church in Ghana. He describes the bishop as impeccably dressed on a seat resembling a throne. His disciples cast banknotes at his feet, while his assets include more than 20 houses, 8 Range Rovers, 5 SUVs, and 3 Chryslers. Writes Dittmer, "News reports claim his churches are filled. These churches are experiencing a boom because they answer the material desires of people," explains Akosua Adumako Ampofo, a professor of the African Studies Institute of the University of Ghana in Accra. "The people, especially from the poorer areas of the city, look for answers for daily needs. Therefore, the promise of wealth, along with a miraculous healing, attracts people. Feet covered with money is not Obinim's only source of wealth, though. Evidently, he knows a thing or two about selling himself." Dittmer says Obinim's latest ploy involves the hashtag Obinim sticker challenge on social media. The hashtag sticker bearing the bishop's face comes on the back of audios with testimonies from devotees describing miracles the sticker has brought them. Says Dittmer, "The Obinim challenge has also garnered its share of the ridicule. UK Ambassador to Ghana, John Benjamin, tweeted, "Yes, I stuck a hashtag Obinim sticker on my head last night, and when I woke up this morning, I had 2 heads, but no brain." And Dittmer continues, "The rest of his theology is also suspect. Obinim claims he can turn into anything, including animals and trees. He says he can retrieve passports from the spiritual world. He claims that he can change body parts. Obinim's members now refer to him as Angel Obinim. He told them he was made an angel by his father Jesus. He insists he can enter people's dreams. And he recently told his church members that he went to heaven, had a conversation with God, and drew the jealousy of Satan." I think Dogo Kente Rinpoche would definitely see this as a case of turning a god into a demon. And so does Pastor Mbewe, who says, "It's like giving children sweets before a meal. You spoil their appetite for that which is truly nutritious. The Bible is primarily about salvation from sin and being sanctified into the image of Christ. We ought to be admiring those among us whose godliness shines like the sun in its noonday strength, but we are fast losing that view. Christians are instead admiring the few individuals with big houses and flashy cars and clothes, even when such individuals are living in sin. Invariably, this emphasis is resulting in churches being rocked with scandals once rare in evangelical circles. Also, prosperity theology makes people think health and wealth are products of a man of God's prayers, which he performs for you when you plant a financial seed, despite the fact that health and wealth are products of good hygiene, nutritious meals, regular exercise, medical treatment, integrity, innovativeness, and hard work. This teaching has become a religious pyramid scam, with the so-called men of God reaping a fortune while their blind followers are getting poorer. Every day, we have to deal with disillusioned individuals who have woken up when it's too late. This teaching is wreaking havoc in the lives of many Christians." And that's Bob Dittmer's article. And we've mentioned Joel Osteen as a proponent of prosperity gospel, but evidently there's also something in America called pampered gospel. At a panel discussion on Evangelicals and the Future of Racial Unity, American evangelist, author, Bible teacher, and founder of Living Proof Ministries said, "What I think has happened here is that in our discipleship, we're not teaching what is normative in the believing life. When we carry our cross and follow Jesus, we're walking into a storm. But what we have subscribed to is a pampered gospel, where we are so afraid of suffering and we are so afraid someone is going to criticize us and hurt our feelings. Moore asserted, "This is the gospel work of Jesus Christ, and we are going with him, whatever it takes, no matter how unpopular it is. He was hated. We have to have thicker skins than that." Now, can we apply that to Buddhism as well? Does toning down the downwards so to fit with our comfort zone also turn a god into a devil? Judy Leaf has this to say on tricycle.org. "It is possible to take the very best and turn it into the very worst. When we first encounter the Dharma and the mind training teachings, we can be so open and excited. It's so refreshing to encounter practical guidelines for developing wisdom and compassion, and to find teachings we can actually apply in our everyday activities. But the more we practice and the more we become familiar with the teachings, the more tempted we are to close down and check out. Instead of appreciating the power of the practice, we begin to insert the heavy hand of ego. At first, meditation and compassion practices seem so beautiful and gentle. We feel enriched and nurtured. But as we continue, we begin to encounter a more threatening and provocative side to mind training practice. It makes us feel unmasked and exposed, embarrassed by our own mindlessness and the puny nature of our compassion for others. As the practice begins to bite or to be more challenging, when it's no longer simply an add-on to our regular way of going about things, but call for a personal transformation, we feel threatened. We reach a crossroads where we can either continue to open or begin to shut down. At this point, we may simply stop practicing, or we may co-opt the practice so that rather than challenging our ego, it nourishes it. We keep the feel-good part and reject the rest. In doing so, we are beginning to turn Dharma into anti-Dharma. It's quite simple. In one approach, we're trying to consume the Dharma. We're trying to fit the Dharma into our small-mindedness. And in the other, we are dissolving our small self into the vastness of the Dharma. When we try to feed on the Dharma, instead of becoming more open and gentle, we become more closed-minded and arrogant. We've succeeded in turning the Dharma, a path that is designed to make us more humble, flexible, compassionate, and awake, into a kind of demon, feeding our worst qualities. Making the teachings into a credential for our ego is a perversion of the Dharma. We are using our attachment to our superficial version of the Dharma to destroy what true Dharma is all about. It is turning a god into a demon. And that is where we will leave it for today, as our time is now up. Once again, thanks for joining the discussion, and I hope you'll be with us again next week. Please dedicate any positive potential from the program to attaining enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Thanks, and goodbye.
stream it.